This is News in No Time. Ed Gordon on today's roundtable. More on the sale of the King Collection, and Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick files a lawsuit over affirmative action. Joining us to discuss these topics and more from our bureau in New York City, Robert George. He's an editorial writer with the New York Post. Also there, Marcelo Suarez Orozco, co-director of immigration studies at New York University. And from our Chicago bureau, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times. She's a columnist there. I thank you all for joining us. Laura, let me start with you. The idea that, quite frankly, when we talked about this on Friday, there was not a lot of hope or optimism that Atlanta would be able to keep these papers. We saw early Saturday that, in fact, that is the case. And kudos to Andy Young and Mayor Franklin for leading this charge.
Absolutely. And some excellent points were made in your previous discussion about the importance of the symbolism of keeping them in Atlanta and keeping them at Morehouse. But I think it's also important to remember these papers are indeed our intellectual property that belong to the world. And it was so important to have this information be housed, particularly in Atlanta, but open and accessible to scholars, to students, to anyone who wants to learn from the legacy of King. It's important to be able to have the opportunity to, as Shirley Franklin put it, to be able to understand the evolution of his works and of his thought and to learn from it. And you wouldn't have been able to do that if this stuff had been scattered all over the world.
Marcelo, help us understand what this means for the school, for Morehouse College. Being a professor yourself, you certainly understand the importance of getting a property like this.
Well, it would automatically make it the epicenter of the basic scholarly scientific research on really an important 20-30 year piece of U.S. history. The papers go from the 1940s to the 1960s. The very important news is that the collection will be kept intact. I think from the scientific, from the scholarly point of view, really a nightmare scenario would have been if the collection had been broken up into different pieces going to different parts of the world. So for the university will automatically mean that it will really be the gravitational center of henceforth scientific scholarly work on this fundamental piece of really U.S. history, but you know, beyond that, really world history. This is a fundamental chapter in the history of civil rights, of human rights, and kudos for the university and for the city of Atlanta.
And Robert George, we should note that this takes a lot of heat off of the family with the idea of it staying in Atlanta, with it going to Morehouse, and them being able to reap the benefits financially. There were some who suggested, I often say incorrectly understanding the idea that there are many families, even though this was Dr. King and we say he belonged to the world, who reap in benefits of selling a relative's legacy. That has been done historically and often looked at as the right thing to do. That was not necessarily the case here, but it seems that this was the best of all worlds for them.
I think that's absolutely correct, Ed. And I mean, I think this is the best of all possible solutions. And I'm hopeful what's happened here will also allow an even greater, in a sense, distribution of King's words, because there was always this tension whenever it came around to either Black History Month or around King's birthday about how much the family would allow various speeches and things to be quoted and what the financial compensation would be and so forth. And I think now that it's with Morehouse and it's with a solid Black-owned Black-operated institution, academic institution, I'm hoping that, in a sense, all that yearly pressure, that daily pressure, is taken off of the family and is really and is now really once again made open for the world, as Marcelo just said.
Go ahead, Laura. You might remember that Bill Clinton at Coretta Scott's funeral a few months ago admonished the community of Atlanta, the African American community of Atlanta, about, he was talking specifically about the King Center and the disrepair there and calling on them to step forward and save their legacy. And I think that connects very in a very important way to the King family. This wasn't just about the responsibility of the King family, it's the responsibility of the community at large. And it looks like in this case they have really stepped up.
And one can only hope that the same will happen for the King Center that has mm-hmm. been in disrepair, frankly, for years, and such a wonderful opportunity for young people if, in fact, it can be restored to its shining brilliance of the first few years.
I was just saying, this also really also elevates Atlanta as well as being once again, in a sense, kind of the capital of Black America, as some people have said. So I think that's also another good thing with this solution.
All right. Well, another capital of Black America, my hometown of Detroit. Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick filed a federal lawsuit last week against Ward Connerly. We should note that we had Ward Connerly on with us, I believe, a week ago and talking about affirmative action and continued fight, the mayor. And we should note that he filed this as a private citizen, suggested that the California businessman and former regent for the University of California, I believe, engaged in widespread voter fraud to get the proposal of affirmative action, banning it on the Michigan ballot of 2006, which is upcoming. Laura Washington, we should note that Kwame Kilpatrick said a few months ago at an NAACP dinner, bring it on. I'm going to fight this fight. And now we see what his intentions are. He's suggesting that over 125,000 Black and Latino voters were falsely told what the petition was in terms of signing it. They thought it was to support affirmative action, according to Mr. Kilpatrick and others.
Bring it on is correct. A lot of people had counted Kwame Kilpatrick out. Didn't think he would even be able to be reelected. He came back strong, and at that time, I think a lot of people said that they saw him now being able to develop the real potential to become a national player in politics. And this may be an early volley, a positive volley, in terms of taking on Ward Connerly. I think it's interesting that Connerly's effort, as far as I can tell, and I don't have all the details yet, has been focused on getting Blacks and Latinos to sign this petition. Now, whether or not he misrepresented it, that remains to be seen. But it's interesting that he would focus on Blacks and Latinos, and it makes me wonder, why did he have to do that? Could he not find enough people who agreed with him in Michigan that he had to take that route? It raises a really interesting question.
Well, actually, it's actually kind of the other. You're sort of damned if you do, damned if you mm-hmm. don't, if you Ward Connerly, because if you focus on just on white voters, it's going to make him seem like, well, he's just getting all the white racists there to get rid of this. I think he felt that if he goes out, if he focuses on Hispanic and Black voters, he can't be accused of it, this being a racist bit of legislation. I think what happens here in the context of Kilpatrick's lawsuit really is it's this definition of what affirmative action means. I mean, the literal definition of it. Connerly's argument is that affirmative action has evolved or devolved, however you want to phrase it, into racial preferences, and he wants to eliminate the context of racial preferences. And if you put that language even in front of Black and Hispanic voters, if they hear it that way, they're going to say, oh well, I don't like the idea of racial preferences, and they'll sign it. And so I think Kilpatrick is saying that's unfair or it's a fraud or whatever, but it really is how you define affirmative action, how it was supposed to be and how it is made today.
Here's the interesting part. The lawsuit also names Michigan Secretary of State Terry Lynn Land to it and other state officials as defendants, suggesting that their overall responsibility is to make sure that Michigan elections are forthright and that they didn't look into this enough, Marcelo, and we should note that the what is called the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative, that's what will be on the ballot. And even that language is interesting, would ban the use of racial and gender preferences in college admissions and public hiring for contracting, effective immediately.
Yes, this is, of course, another round of what we saw earlier in Michigan involving, of course, the case that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Both
at
cases.
The University of Michigan, the both cases, the case at the law school and the case at the college. But there is this use of language that Robert mentioned that some have said is somewhat Orwellian. So the Michigan Civil Rights Commission, would end some forms of affirmative action as we've come to understand it over the last generation. So there are interesting questions, and it will be important to see moving forward how this case unfolds, because this also repeats an earlier cycle in California also involving the former regent. So stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned indeed. And, Laura, as I mentioned, the idea of just calling it the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative is interesting, and that's how it will be placed on the ballot. We should note that representatives of the initiative have suggested that the complaint is totally frivolous, and they believe it will be thrown out.
And if Connolly's people did do the right thing and did represent this initiative correctly, I think what it may represent is there is a growing backlash among people of color against affirmative action. There is some growing discomfort with the way it has been used to imply. I know I see this on, I teach at DePaul University, and I see this on campus all the time. Black and Latino students are very uncomfortable with being perceived as being there because of their race and not because of their merit. And I
Definitely.
Think that that is certainly true of the younger generation. So
yeah, but
maybe
here's
that's
the reality.
Some of those folks really
even when I
petition.
Was going to school, that is the thought of many, unfortunately, mm-hmm. professors as well as fellow students, that when they see minorities there, they just quite frankly assume, well, the only reason you're here is because of affirmative action. Whether or not you're there off of merit and oftentimes perhaps even brighter than the one who is judging you, Marcella.
Yes, indeed. And as Supreme Court Justice Sandra Connor wrote in that majority opinion, we still have a long ways to go in terms of achieving equal opportunity in the United States. And perhaps for the next generation or and beyond, we really need to continue to work.
But even in that decision, she was hoping it was basically would sunset in, you know, 20 years or however, 20 or 30 years. And,
right.
And so she was, in a sense, seeing and hoping to see an end to the practice. And so...
Well, that's the interesting note, because when you initially talked about affirmative action, there were questions of grandfathering some of this. So to put that against the sunset is an interesting note in terms of how people view it. It really depends on which side of the fence you sit, Laura.
That's absolutely.
All right. Let's turn our attention to what we're seeing really raise in intensity in terms of conversation over this past weekend, and that is bipartisan support opposing insurgent amnesty, which was put forth as a possibility by Iraq's prime minister, the plan for providing insurgents amnesty. We saw senators across the board come out and suggest that this is not the way to go. One, Mitch McConnell, Republican of Kentucky, saying granting immunity to people who have killed Americans is not acceptable. And I don't. And here's the interesting language here. And this comes from Mr. McConnell after hearing from the prime minister of Iraq. And I don't believe that's what the Iraqi government wants to do. This often, Robert George, is yeah. why America finds itself in the position it does, because there is this sense of paternalism no matter what.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, 2 weeks ago when the president went over to when President Bush went over to Iraq and shook hands with Prime Minister Maliki, you know, he said, I'm here to show that, you know, we stand with the Iraqi people. We stand with this government and so forth. And now, of course, you've got members of Congress up in arms because, you know, Maliki is making, I mean, in my estimation, I think it's an outrageous suggestion that you're going to give the insurgents amnesty. But Maliki obviously is in a sense wanting to show that he's not a lackey. He's not going to be a lackey to the United States, and he wants to make some decisions on his own. And it seems to me that domestically the Democrats must be hitting themselves that this didn't actually happen like last week when they were drafting all of these timetable to withdrawals, because it would have given them a great talking point on the situation.
Here's another interesting quote from McConnell, which happened on this week with George Stephanopoulos. He suggested that the Iraqi war, in talking about the support for it, what we've seen here is, quote, a minuscule number of casualties compared to any war in American history, end quote. When you hear that kind of language, Marcelo, that rings very interesting in terms of where we are, where the American public is, and why a senator would even say that.
Well, in the context of the history of the last century, indeed, the number of casualties is much smaller in proportion to what we've seen in certainly World War II, Vietnam, Korea, and so on. The question is really in terms of the Iraqi proposal, and why it is somewhat unorthodox is that in general, amnesties tend to come to the table in the context of a peace settlement. So if you look at, for example, the insurgencies that we saw in Central America recently, El Salvador, Guatemala, what we've seen in Colombia, in general, the insurgents and the governments make a kind of a peace treaty, and then it's when the notion of offering, granting some degree of amnesty comes to the table. What we see in Iraq here is really kind of an asymmetrical amnesty, which I really think goes into the symbolic issues that are at stake here. As the Iraqis continue to struggle for some form of legitimacy and authority in what is a very, very complicated situation unfolding in the field. So, unfortunately, we're going to continue to see casualties. And I think that this is a kind of a way to try to initiate a conversation with their opponents over there in the field.
Laura, with a little less than a minute.
Well, and that conversation, of course, is very difficult to have, as Marcelo points out, when you still have a war raging on. We're in a very chaotic environment. I think this proposal, it needs to be respected as a proposal that's coming from the Iraqi government, but it really needs to be examined closely. You know, how do you implement something like this in this environment? And how do you decide a key part of the amnesty proposals? How do you, you're going to decide who has committed a terrorist act? And if you have not been proven to have committed a terrorist act, then you will be given amnesty. I don't know how you do that in this kind of environment.
All right. Well, more to come. Laura Washington, greatly appreciate it. And Marcelo and Robert, thank you very much. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.